Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadist for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode. I have a sore throat, so just excuse me right now. I might sound a little sexier than usual if you're not watching the video. Well, that's a whole different thing. But anyway, welcome to another episode of Secular Jihadist for Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali A. Rizvi. I am your host, and then I also, so is Armin Navabi, my co-host. Armin, how are you today?
I'm always the same. You don't need to ask me that. if there's any issues, I'll let you know.
Okay? You'll pipe up and you'll tell me?
All right, yes. Oh, yeah.
He's a monotone. I mean, he's very, very rational. A very, very rational guy.
Armin is like an Iranian Sheldon from Big Bang Theory, I always think.
Yeah, I know. It's a good thing. It's a good thing that we have him on. He's a lot of fun. So, in any case, the voice that you heard right now, which is probably, I have to admit, a lot sexier than mine, is the voice of our guest today, who is Imtiaz Shams. And Imtiaz Shams is... And this is a guy I'm a huge fan of. He's based in the UK, and he's done some incredible work. He runs an organization called Faith to Faithless. He is an ex-Muslim. He used to be a devout Muslim, and then he left Islam. And now what he does is he helps other people who are in need because he's been through the experience himself. So just a little bit about him, and I'll let you speak to this more yourself, Imtiaz, because that'll be a lot more powerful coming from you than me. I think your parents have Bengali origin, but you grew up in Saudi Arabia as a very religious Muslim, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you used to visit Mecca every year for the Umrah pilgrimage?
Sometimes twice. It's very common to go more than once. Yeah.
I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I used to do that. My family used to also go at least once or twice a year. And sometimes it was in the summer and it was really hot. And I've talked about this before, how with the Ihram, you know, you don't have to wear underwear, which is great.
I don't know about that. I don't remember that.
Yeah, we've talked about,
some people wear underwear, some people don't.
Wasn't there a story that a lot of the ones that don't wear underwear, they rub themselves on some of...
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's gross, man.
Armin, going too fast for me. I need a little bit of foreplay. We'll get to this later in the podcast. Going Commando in Mecca. Huh? Sorry?
No, but that was a pretty shocking story I couldn't believe that this is something that happens there. Did you guys did you guys notice anything like that when you were there?
There's a lot. They tell you to stay away the kids are kept together. There's a lot of people, I mean, from stealing shoes to sexual harassment to people rubbing up against you to stealing your money because people. So here's the thing. The background of what we're talking about is that you have to wear these two towel-like garments and drape them around yourself. And that's essentially the uniform of going on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And you don't really have pockets. So people usually have fanny packs or something that they tie around themselves, and often they have all their cash and their savings there. And they do get robbed. There's a lot of stuff that happens. But anyway, I just wanted to connect with you on that because we had the same experience. Where did you live in Saudi Arabia, your family?
I grew up in Riyadh, in the capital city.
So did I. When were you there?
I was there from 1989 or 90 till like sort of 19 for 10 years basically. Yeah, so to 1996. Yeah. I want to say 7, 8.
Yeah. I barely remember. I was there from I think around 1982 to 1992.
I went to school in a place called Manarat al Riyadh, and
I did 12th grade in Manarat al Riyadh.
No way. That's crazy.
I know so much other stuff about you, and this is the stuff I didn't know. I went to high school. Yeah, 12th grade I did in Manarat al Riyadh. And I also did second grade there when I started out.
Interesting.
Yeah,
it's a weird school, man. It's a weird school.
We have to talk about this offline because I want to know if Sophia Gar was still there, the English teacher. But anyway,
yes, that rings a bell. I don't know why that rings
British,
a bell.
The British, Pakistani guy. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to that big mustache.
All right, guys, let's get into some less insider stuff.
Right. So, Imtiaz, essentially, so he was, when he was in Saudi Arabia, he was reading a lot of, he was praying, he was fasting, going on this Mecca pilgrimage. He's memorizing the Quran. He was reading books on Islam, just devouring them, and then moved with his family to the UK just before 9/11. And then 9/11 happened, and you had some interesting experiences there. You said that people started calling you a terrorist at school. They started drawing bombs and explosives on your shirt. So you were actually bullied for being Muslim. And right? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's annoying that I can't run upstairs and get the shirt. I have the shirt still. I carry it with, like, I've got it. And I've got a notebook which has some of the last day of school, you know, when you're leaving school and, like, right. People's, like, notes about what they thought about you and stuff. And right. I had a bunch of, like, bombs drawn. I don't know where it's here somewhere. I can find it. But, yeah, basically, I went to a school that at the time there wasn't that many Muslims who had joined that school, although that school over time has become it's got a large Muslim population today. And then they got shut down. But when I was there, after 9/11, it was a very sort of working class white and black school. And, you know, the kids would read The Sun, which is like our tabloid, slightly racist newspaper. And basically it was banter. It wasn't like done in a necessarily a punch me in the face and run away bullying way. It was much more like, ha ha ha, you're a terrorist. Right.
Right.
But that's obviously how this stuff works. It's often kind of insidious. And yeah, so my nickname at school was Inventively Terrorist.
Say that again? What?
My nickname at school was Terrorist. So, you know, you get a nickname. Sorry. Yeah, Terrorist. Yeah. So it'd be like, you know, Osama bin Laden jokes, things like that. I have Bengali genes, so I couldn't grow anything here. So I couldn't have the full-on beard. But yeah, so I went through kind of what you'd call anti-Muslim kind of hatred. Which a lot of Muslims, I think, went through after 9/11. It's not, you know, at different scales. So no one beat the shit out of me for being Muslim, but there was a lot of kind of racism, name calling, things like that, and that made me more religious actually, because you know your political identity of Islam is often built around this concept of the world is bad. You know, Islam will solve the world. So when you're going through
it's us against the world, right?
Exactly. Like, and it reinforces that kind of rhetoric actually. And it makes you quite vulnerable to quite extreme rhetoric as well. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think to some extent that happened with me. I didn't become solidly like an extremist, you know, with ideas about what I was going to do, but I was politically quite radical, I would say. And that happened after 9/11.
Right. And so you talk about how it made you sort of, I guess, were you clinging to the religion more? Were you clinging to the identity more? Or was it just a sort of amalgamation or a mixture of the two?
It was an amalgamation. I think identity is an interesting one because actually I didn't necessarily fit in with the Muslims around me because I felt like they weren't active enough, you know, like they weren't doing the things that we needed to do to change the world. So as an example of that, I've always been into technology and stuff. Like I'm in technology right now. And I remember there's a Zionist tool called Megaphone, which is funded by sort of Hasbara type things. And I remember as a Muslim, I was like, oh, that's very smart. They're funding this kind of thing. I was like, why don't we build a megaphone for pro-Palestinian people? You know? So for me, it was very much, how do you build and how do you grow? And what I always find personalities very interesting because actually, what am I doing now? It's not very dissimilar, right? I believe in building things for ex-Muslims so that we can support each other. So I think personalities don't change, but my views obviously changed quite a lot about what I believe in.
Do you find that a lot of ex-Muslims took Islam seriously when they were Muslim? I don't know if this has also been my experience, but I don't know if this is a trend or is that just the people that maybe it's not most ex-Muslims, but most ex-Muslim activists were also very serious with Islam when they were Muslim.
Yes, and I think one thing to point out on that is it's the personalities that don't change, right? So the ones who are kind of very interested in how does the world function? Why is the world the way it is? How can I make the world better or change it to fit in with my paradigm? Those people continue being the same people, but their personalities don't change, but their viewpoints change. So you focus on similar things, right? So I think if I remained Muslim, I'd probably have remained, have been quite an active Muslim, probably in the political scene, probably with an activism, with some flexibility about like how I think about things like homophobia, because I always had trouble with homophobia. I just couldn't be homophobic. It was so hard for me, you know, no matter how much you want to, because it's there in the faith and it's quite obvious. It's difficult because you don't want to hate on gay people. You know?
Yeah, I think I had, I relate to that. For me, it was mainly the misogyny and the, you know, the stuff with the women. And I think it was a mixture of everything. But I think another factor, another reason for that is also we want to stay consistent. So if someone tells me, if I'm raised thinking that this is a word of God, and I have to believe it, I'm looking at it as a word of, I mean, I intellectually, I need to be consistent. I can't have the sort of wishy-washy people like, oh, it's okay, just go have a drink, it's all right, you know. So
yeah, exactly.
I can't, so, and that eventually led me to abandon it all as well. So I think that that's also a factor that goes into it.
Armin, yeah, exactly. But then people say like, okay, so you tried to take it seriously, but it was too hard for you and you really wanted to sin and that's why you became an ex-Muslim. That's what they would say.
If you want to sin, the best thing you can do is remain Muslim. It's easier.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you can ask, or Christian, actually.
And you know, I think I often find this kind of insecurity from what I would call sort of Muslims who consider themselves and other Muslims call them bad Muslims, where they kind of look at ex-Muslims and go, ha, at least I'm not one of you people. And they are extra hard on us, I find.
Yeah.
So I find conservative, orthodox, religious Muslims often to be nicer to me as a human being than sometimes these bad Muslim types, because they're kind of making up for a lot of sort of bad stuff they're doing.
It's a consistency thing. I think there's this weird sort of vehement disagreement, but there's a sort of mutual respect. Right. And I know we're going to get a lot of shit for saying this, but there is a sort of understanding that I actually do think the conservative Muslims tend to be more consistent, more intellectually consistent with what they believe. Like if they say that there is some rule or something else in that they believe or that they think that's part of Islam, they'll back it up with verses. They have the knowledge to back it up. They don't say, well, you know, it's not in context. Well, then what's the context? Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a scholar. Like
I think what we share with the conservative Muslims is that we think it matters, right?
Right.
A lot of the more moderate, wishy-washy Muslims, they just don't care, right? Like not just most people in general don't care about philosophy, theology, politics. It's just something you watch on the news.
Sure.
But I mean, ex-Muslim activists and Muslim conservatives, they read the Quran, they read the Hadith. When they find each other, they disagree with each other and they might sometimes hate each other, but they also enjoy challenging each other. They like the fact that they're not just dismissing these verses as, oh, it's just a metaphor. It could mean anything to anybody, right? You could actually have a challenging debate with somebody.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I will just make a caveat point there, which is that I do feel like these kind of quote-unquote moderate Muslims or progressive Muslims or quote-unquote bad Muslims are often made to feel like they can't have a view. So, and I'm not saying from us necessarily, I mean from within their own community, that there's this kind of one right way of doing things. If you're a person who's not homophobic and Muslim and you're completely comfortable in defending that, someone will shut you out, right? It is easy to be shut out like that. So I think I want those Muslims to actually feel comfortable, because then you can take apart ideas. I mean, Armin, you're a big believer in taking apart ideas, right?
Right.
No matter what they are and who they are. I think a lot of moderates don't actually get, I mean, I'm not talking about the media. I'm talking about within our communities. If you're that uncle that does not believe that women should X, Y, Z, you believe that they should have the rights to, you know, maybe sleep with people before marriage.
I
can't say that, right? Yeah. You cannot have that theological position.
Right, right. I'm not discouraging them from coming forward. I'm just saying that they don't come forward as much as they... I wish they would come forward more often. I would like to invite them to come and challenge us more often. I just feel like that more of the challenge comes from the conservative. But to be fair, this is the conservative that we know online, because I find that most conservatives don't even know yet that much about the fact that ex-Muslim movement is... Even till now, I'm still finding like many conservative Muslims saying like there is no such thing as an ex-Muslim. You can never go back from Islam, but it's changing. That's changing a lot.
I think it's changed almost irreversibly. I think that era, Armin, is over. Like, we have made it over. I am meeting so many people completely out randomly who are like, oh yeah, I know someone, or I've come across this on my time in surfing YouTube between porn or whatever it is, right?
Right.
Like, there's so many people.
But you're talking about people that are active online. You're talking about people that are active online.
No. In my barbershops, in my like, because I live in a very Muslim area. I've always lived in Muslim areas, and I do talk to people, and I do like pull things out surreptitiously, right? And honestly, man, like it is, maybe in the UK, maybe it's just a UK thing, but honestly, it's everywhere. Like, it's ridiculous how many randomers know ex-Muslims.
I think that too, but Armin, there's another thing. Even these conservative Muslims like that are on TV in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, and I mean, there's all these, you see these clips on YouTube, they're warning about atheism. They're like, our youth is going towards atheism. They're turning away from Islam. They're abandoning Islam. There's in Saudi Arabia, actually in 2014, they designated atheism a terrorist offense because of this. So, I mean, they're very aware of it.
I know that they're aware of it more than ever before, but I still think it's still not the majority. And I think that we're heading there though, right?
Sure.
Even the fact that, even knowing that we exist is going to make more people check. Just our numbers. This is why ex-Muslims, even if you're not an activist, announcing yourself as an ex-Muslim, if it's safe for you, you're already doing a service, because our numbers will make people want to check out what we're saying. Because for a very long time, until very recently, Muslims believed that the main challenge to Islam was Christianity. Now they're noticing that atheism is actually the main challenge.
And it's in their own communities and their own youth.
Yeah,
right? Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So speaking of that, let's move on. Imtiaz, I wanted to sort of continue with your story. So you're in this situation. You come here and then 9/11 happens. You're going through this sort of bullying by sort of these anti-Muslim, you're a victim of this anti-Muslim sentiment. And then eventually, though, as you grow older, you leave it all. You leave the faith. So how did that jump happen, when holding on to it stronger and then letting it go completely?
You know, I couldn't have answered that question when I left Islam. I couldn't have told you why did I leave it. It's taken me about, you know, half a decade of me just working with so many ex-Muslims and helping other ex-religious people for my charity program to really realize what happened. And what it is that it's not that I had new questions. It's that the answers to my questions that I already have, that all religious people, all people into political groups, all of these people have, it's those answers that stop making sense as you get older, as your critical thinking develops, as you meet new people and new ideas. So as an example, this is the story I always say. My first book when I was 7 years old, probably, or 8 years old, was Riyadh al-Salihin by Imam Nawawi. And it's like a collection of hadith, you know, sayings and actions of the Prophet. And one of them was a narration by Aisha, you know, the very controversial wife of Muhammad, who was quite young. And I remember reading it, and it's where she says, I am this age, 8, 9 years old, and playing with dolls and stuff like that. And I remember as a kid going, oh, that's weird. I'm that age. She's that age. Mm-hmm. Wait, is that like, how does that work, right?
Just for clarification for the audience, in case some of them don't know. So Aisha was the child bride of Muhammad. Muhammad married her when she was 6 and consummated the marriage when she was 9 years old. He was 53 at the time. So
yeah. And as a kid, you don't go there that far. You kind of go, oh, that's weird. And then like, don't care about it, right? And obviously Yeah, but we're not all like you are, Armin. We're not. We're child geniuses.
No,
we're teasing you, Armin.
It's so fun to tease Armin. And then I remember, like, when I kind of got older, I had answers to that. Oh, wait, no, she wasn't nine. She was older than that. Or women hit puberty much earlier when they were younger. And actually, she was a lot older, blah, 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 blah. Lots of these kind of mechanisms to deal with that difficulty. And you know what? As I got older, that just didn't make sense anymore because she said she was nine. Like, you know,
yeah.
If I dispute that, I dispute all of Sahih Hadith. And then there's more than that, you know, like
actions are not...
Yeah, playing with dolls. There's loads of stuff, right? Loads of stuff.
Well, there's several dozen hadith about Aisha that say that she was that age.
Exactly. And you know, and obviously that's not the only reason I left Islam, but that's like one of, imagine 10,000 different data points like that, right? Where you kind of go, wait a second, that answer that I had for that question actually doesn't make any sense, or it doesn't make sense anymore now that I've seen this idea or blah, blah, blah. So that's what kind of happened to me, that the questions were always there. It's the answers that stop making sense. And if you speak to other people from a Christian background, evangelical Christian or Mormon or Catholic or Jehovah's Witness or ultra-Orthodox Jews, they'll say the same thing. They had these little questions and everyone does, but it's just that they started processing those questions differently and the answers stopped making sense. And that's what happened to me.
I think that's a really good way. It's a really good summation to put it. And I think that whenever I kind of dabbled in and out while I was growing up, so... Sure. But for me also, ultimately, you know, that process, that intellectual process of consistency, of that's really what did it. And I wanted to actually recall what Yasmin Muhammad, who was one of our co-hosts here earlier, that she said that, you know, often people say it's because of oppression. It's because, you know, you've gone, that she was married to an Al-Qaeda member by force. She wore the niqab all of her, you know, for years and years. And she was forced to do it all. She was abused, everything. But ultimately, she says that the thing that got her out of Islam ultimately was going to university, taking a comparative religion course, yep, and critical thinking. The process wasn't, it wasn't born out of oppression. It wasn't a reaction. It was a response to just her own mind and making sense of things.
Right.
I think this is a misconception that I think a lot of people have.
Yeah, a lot of people think that we had it too tough and it was anti-woman and we didn't like it, so we left. No, I think most people, it just didn't make sense. It's just like, what the fuck is this shit, right?
I mean, I'm very careful in how I talk about sort of what ex-Muslims' journeys look like because my journey is so different from, you know, Armin's. I would say actually me and Armin probably have a similar-ish journey, although God was not my only friend when I was a kid. I had other friends. but what I'm trying to say is actually I do come across people where, just like for me, I understand someone that says to me, they're an aid worker, they're a charity worker, they've dealt with young homeless children, children with cancer in their brains, and they can't believe in God, right? Like, that's a different experience from me, but I get that. And in the same way, people go through suffering in their own life, and they're a girl, they're gay especially, can you imagine? And that forces you to think about the theology. It's like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And often it can be one or the other way around. For me, it was theology that came first. It wasn't suffering. It wasn't my own kind of what I went through. It was theology, because theology had an impact on the suffering I saw for other people.
Right. I could explain the suffering away with theology if I wanted to.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what I used to do. I actually, the whole suffering issue never bothered me that much, because I was just thinking, I was like, this is a sliver of life. You know, God's on the other side. He's got all the stuff that we don't know.
So this my explanation was, this whole life was like a fraction of a ticket.
Exactly.
Infinity. Exactly. Who the fuck cares what happens to us here?
Isn't that amazing that our human kind of sense for justice is so powerful that even though we were taught this from a young age,
right,
you can start feeling, but I know that person across the road and they're suffering, and is that right, even if this is a sliver, right? And then you open your mouth and you say the words, it's a test, and you feel like a piece of shit because you cannot say it is a test to a man or a woman who's been through a domestically violent relationship, who's lost their arms and legs. Like, it's just, you feel like shit if you say that, right?
This is what happens when you put people before God. This is why I didn't have any friends.
Yeah. So, how did your parents react to it? Did you, did they know, or your family overall?
They have to kind of know. Look, you know, for me, my family and me have quite a close relationship, and religion is such an important part of that relationship. It is the optics of how we view each other, or it was the optics of how you view each other. And naturally, if you want a relationship with them, you have to switch it around and you have to make it about love. So I think what I try to do with my family is, because you can imagine, I was doing all this work with ex-Muslim communities secretly as improvaganza for like years, right? Like underground with just a secret name and all that. And I couldn't tell my family. And I was like, I need to tell my family because I need to do this. I need to come out. I just need to help. Like, I can't be shut.
Come out. That is what it is. It's about coming out.
Yeah. It's about coming out for me. And so I thought so long and hard about my family. And what I did is I actually took all the learning that I had gained from helping other ex-Muslims come out to their families and stuff, which is weird. So I was helping people come out before I had, right? And I took a lot of that and I really used it with my family. I reframed our relationship to be about love, and I've never let people kind of walk over me. I'm quite careful about that. But my family know, like, okay, I care about them. I haven't changed that much. I used to, like, they know me when I was a kid. I would, like, once I was 14, 15 years old, and I saw a boy getting robbed for his phone, and me and this other little kid, we took him to the police station, and we were like home late, and like, you know, my mom was like freaking out. But I've always been like that, right? And I said that to my mom. I said, Mom, like, I'm just doing what I've always done. And these are people, whether you agree with us or not, that they need help. Like, yeah. I need help. And I think reframing it in language that they understand, because they know me better than anyone else, really helped. Now, it's not easy. It's always up and down. It's always up and down. Like, it really, really is. But, you know, like, I think we're at a place where actually they kind of get that I'm not a nasty person and da, 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 da. And I love my parents. So, you know, but it's difficult, you know, it's difficult. It's always difficult. I have not come across a single ex-Muslim really yet who's had it easy, you know?
Yeah, this is.
I had it easy with my parents, actually.
Me too. Go ahead.
I'm not talking about just parents. I'm talking about everything. You can't go back to Iran. You literally have a country you cannot go back to, Armin.
Oh, that, yeah, in that case, yes.
It used to be one country, now it's in the big two. Malaysia is after me too now, apparently.
You're right about that. I was like, I consider myself relatively privileged, and I know that Armin, to some extent,
my parents thanked God when I left Islam.
So, and that is not the typical experience. I mean, we had Sarah Hader on the show earlier, and she also had the same thing, that her experience has been unique in that sense, that we have had the privilege of, I guess, parental acceptance or even parental tolerance, which is not really, in my experience, the ex-Muslims that I've met. Most of them, especially the girls, especially the women, they just, for the men, somehow it's a lot easier, but for the women.
Well, it's not that they were really tolerant to me. I was intolerant to their non-Islamic ways, and that's why they were accepting of me leaving Islam.
You became like a Basidi.
Can I just throw something out there, which I'm not sure if I believe yet, but it's just I've got a few anecdotal data points for it, which is actually, I think by and large, Muslim families can and over time do accept their ex-Muslim kids. It's just a shit ton of work. Because I've come across people from extreme, like, proper hardcore families and from kind of liberal families where they've come out as both ex-Muslim and gay or whatever it is, right? And as long as you frame the how the kids tell the family and how the kids expect the relationship will change over like a 5-year period, actually I've come across almost no
Rana.
Only one or two
Rana.
Yes. Well, Rana's problem is she's from Saudi Arabia, so it's a government level issue, right?
But her brother wants to kill him.
Yes, but not her whole family necessarily. So my point I'm trying to make is,
kill her.
That's true. Kill, you know, you're absolutely right. And they're absolutely families, especially when it's a woman involved, especially when it's like honor violence, where we're not talking that. But generally speaking, there's always one member in your family that will come around, and that one member of the family reduces the honor issue in the whole family because the shame kind of is out the closet. Right. You've come out.
If you're that you really believe in hell and you think your son or daughter is going to go to hell because of this, even if you want to be accepting of them, I mean, if you love them, then you're going to be worried.
Yeah, like, yeah, absolutely.
Heaven with that,
but you know what? Cognitive dissonance is a hell of a drug. And if you believe in Islam, you have the method of being as cognitively dissonant as you want, which includes accepting your son is an ex-Muslim and
probably
went over to hell. You know,
these are the Muslims that don't think about stuff a lot, so they don't take things.
I don't agree with that, Armin. No. Yeah. I'm talking about quite religious Muslims. I've come across quite a few.
But religious. You can be religious without thinking about stuff. You can be moderate without thinking about stuff. But I'm talking about people that are trying to be consistent in their ideas.
What I'm trying to say is you can be as consistent as you want, but you cannot look your son in the eye who is gay and ex-Muslim, let's say, for example, and say you are going to, well, you can, but it's a very, very difficult thing. It's a lot harder than people think.
No, you can love them. You can love them and accept them and be worried for them. And you know, it's not. There's a difference between being accepting of them as a parent, but still thinking God wouldn't accept them, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, I get that.
I think I'll give you an example. I think of Imtiaz, what you're talking about, and it's not just a matter of presentation. But I'll give you one example personally, where you said anecdotal data points. Well, I have one, and I'm not going to reveal names here, but it's actually something that's very close to me. Is that you know, this guy who was, pretty well-to-do, good guy, Pakistani guy. He met this girl who'd been disowned for, you know, her family for many, many years. They sort of wanted to get married. And her parents had disowned her for abandoning Islam. So, you know, she abandoned Islam. She went out there. They just thought, okay, now she's not doing Islam. That means that she's going to become immoral. You know, she had a boyfriend. She was, you know, she had her own place, all of that. And it became a big deal for the parents. Like, we don't want to associate with her. Didn't talk to her for many years. And she called him back. She's like, yeah, I'm marrying this guy. You know, he's also Pakistani. He also comes from a Muslim family. And, you know, he's got, this is his career. He had a good career. And they came back into her. They're like, okay, we accept you now. Because I think one of their biggest fears was that if she leaves Islam, she's never going to get married to a good guy again. And maybe that was their fear. It wasn't even the Islam thing as much as, okay, how is this going to look morally or culturally? And then they're like, oh, she's getting married to a good guy. The guy's family accepts her. It's okay. Now, and then they came back into her life. So maybe it's...
Time.
That's, people, I guess... So a lot of times it's not even about the ideology or the belief. Yeah. It's often just that what will people think and cultural...
I have a question, but I want to ask the patron question in the live chat first. Mm-hmm. Sayed is asking, can you talk about morality at some point? For example, without God, how do you prove something is wrong? Are you more relativist or do you believe in objective morality?
By the way, that's an Armin question, isn't it?
I covered it in a chapter of my book, and I will send you a free PDF copy.
Free PDFs.
Yeah. For you. There's actually, to Sayed Ali who asked the question, there's actually, if you read Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, that actually goes into that in a lot of detail. And if you don't want to read the entire book, he has a TED talk on this, which is just 17 minutes, but it's... He sums up the whole idea really nicely.
My book is very basic, and I actually tell people at the end of each chapter, I tell people what to read if they want to get in more deep into that topic. And I recommend Sam Harris's The Moral Landscape book at the end of that chapter.
What I liked about the way you kind of went through on your book, Armin, is that it's really much like a dun dun dun. It's very like simplified. Do you know what I mean? It's very like one after another.
That's why your entire book is brilliant. Your entire book is great because I think that. For a lot of the arguments and the philosophy and everything, even if you read in The God Delusion, which is relatively straightforward, I don't think it's as accessible to many average
people. Let's not talk about my book. Let's talk about it.
Armin's book is called Why There Is No God. It is a constant bestseller on Amazon. It's doing really, really well. So, go out and get it.
My question for MTS. Which I forgot. Oh, yeah. So MTS recently got invited.
Armin is also very good looking.
Unfortunately, very married as well.
Yeah, no, we're not going to interrupt him anymore. Go ahead, Armin.
All right. So MTS recently I've heard about this event that finally there was a Muslim event in London, and they invited an ex-Muslim, and I was, and this was in the news. I was like, this is amazing. And I was like, I have to go check out who they invited. And then I went and checked it out, and it was Imtiaz.
It was you.
It was him. And that was so, you know, I kept on putting this as a challenge. I was like, dear Muslims, if you want to show that you're accepting, if you want to show that you're not sensitive little snowflakes that are not worried about competing with other ideas, invite ex-Muslims to your event. Show people that you accept challenges. And this is it. This is the thing that I didn't expect them to do for a very long time. They invited an ex-Muslim to a Muslim event, which is very amazing. New. I mean, how was it? First of all, tell us, how did you manage to, did they reach out to you or did you reach out to them? What was the environment like? Were they welcoming? And also tell us, after that, tell us a little bit about your strategies with how you talk to Muslims, what your goal is, and depending on the kind of Muslim you're talking to.
Sure. So, I mean, the first thing is, if you look at a lot of my work, especially early on, when I was just a kid on Reddit, like just a random, my name Imtiaz wasn't on it. Like it was just an anonymous name. It's always been, how do I focus on people? I went through something. I felt alone. And almost selfishly, I wanted to get help for myself. And then when I couldn't get that, I wanted to help other people not go through what I went through. And that's often what you come across with kind of more secretive online activists, you know, like, they care much more about kind of, I think the human element of ex-Muslims. And I've kept to that. Like, I'm speaking much more now about ideas and stuff like that. And that's always filtered through my work. But actually, my first focus was always human rights. And I think with, Muslims in Britain, because I'm from such a, you know, religious tradition, and I've always been part of that community in many ways, it's home to me, right? Like, Muslims are home to me. Right? Ex-Muslims have become home because I don't really have a choice, but actually Muslims are always my home. And like that space and that spectrum of what it means to be a Muslim has always been interesting to me. And I know a lot of ex-Muslims don't always agree with me about where I sit on my views on that space in the spectrum. I think a lot of ex-Muslims think I'm a bit wishy-washy in terms of Muslims and this and that. But I honestly believe there's a lot of space that will be created and is being created. It's not always popular. And it's not always the majority, but it's interesting to me. And I think I've been in that for like as long as I've been into the Muslim space, ex-Muslim space, right? So from the beginning, I was going to like progressive Islamic events from 5 years ago and all that kind of stuff, right? So these guys, they've seen me on the scene for years, years and years and years. I know a lot of them. I know like some of my closest friends are sort of Muslims who are from that sort of crew of people, from varying levels of conservatism themselves. So I have friends who are kind of reform, ex-jihadist types. And then I've got friends who are like actually very, I would say, Islamist, right? I have friends who would be called Islamists. So I keep that because for me, it's about the human behind the idea. Ideas are very important. I'm not denying that. But I found that I would rather be friends with someone whose ideas I really am disgusted by, but I think they're good people, than with someone that is an ex-Muslim but is a shitty person. Do you know what I mean?
But so, would you say friends or would you say acquaintances? Like, do you, if there
I
is...
I have probably two friends who are quite Islamist, like friends. The rest are sort of acquaintances. Yeah. Yeah. I would go that far. Yeah. 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 I would go that far. So, and that's because they respect that I don't judge them, right? They know that I come from the same cloth they do in many ways. I don't judge them for who they are, but I do judge their ideas, and they get that. And actually, they respect that they can have a discussion with me they can't even have with their friends sometimes, right? With their colleagues and friends. So it's controversial for, I think, a lot of ex-Muslims, the way I kind of handle my relationships and stuff. But what's happened is, because I'm clearly someone who's so steeped into that community, the people who run this conference know me quite well, right? They know me really well. I've went to two of their conferences. I went to the first conference they ever did, and I paid for that myself. Like, I went on my own back, right? Just because I really wanted to go, and I left Qawwali, and they had a big Qawwali in the end, whatever, right?
So oh, yeah, I love Qawwali too.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I think on the back of that, you know, and also, man, like, things are changing for ex-Muslims. We're becoming... in the world, like, people are talking about, you can't ignore us. They did, you know, the MEND people, who are quite sort of an Islamist political group, you know, charity, and also like just, you know, Yasser Qadri was there. They did a event called Losing My Religion, which is basically to scare the living daylights out of Muslim parents who are scared about the children leaving Islam. Yet it was a bait and switch. 4,000 people went to that. 4,000 Muslims went to that. And almost not once did they really talk about ex-Muslims. They used it as a bait and switch to get 4,000 people angry, right? Scared out of their wits so that they can vote in the line that men wanted. That's how scummy these people are, right? But the fact that that happened and the fact that mosques across our country are speaking about ex-Muslims means that New Horizons, which is the Muslim sort of conference organization, felt probably not only do they trust me, but hey, actually, this is something we should and can talk about now, right? It's that kind of tipping point that I think we've hit. And so I went to that. To answer your question, I was shit scared. I was so, so scared. I was like, I'm so privileged because I'm getting to do this. I don't know what people are going to say, right? They don't know what people are going to say. They don't know what media is going to say because there's media there. And actually, it was amazing. So there was, imagine a room, packed out, lots of people visibly what you'd say Muslim, although that doesn't always mean that they're Muslim, you know, wearing hijabs and stuff, and just a big mix. And, you know, I had so many Muslims afterward come to me going, telling me their stories about how their partner or their friend or their sibling left Islam and how initially they might have rejected them, but actually over time they've grown a bond.
Wow,
and their own fears, man. Like they're so scared, right? They're so scared because they don't know what to do. And honestly, man, like this is why I have so much optimism. Like I've had optimism from day one, which to be honest, wasn't very well placed on day one because actually things were really shit. But honestly, it is happening. Like it is not, in the West, I'm not talking about the
Muslim countries. Yeah, I was going to actually get there, but it's like, this is your experience in the West.
In the West. And look, I'm fucking privileged. I am in the West, right? Like, I'm the West. There's no denying that, right? So in the West, things are changing forever. It is having impacts on Muslim countries too, because guess what? When we do a documentary on Vice about ex-Muslims, Arabs across the Middle East will watch it, right? Like whether it's going to have an impact on the government, I don't know. Of course not. But ex-Muslims in those countries feel empowered too. Whether they have any power, who knows? I don't know, right?
Do you think you're gonna get invited? Like more ex-Muslims will get invited. So this was a very progressive Muslim community, wasn't it? Relatively,
kind of. It's more of a.
Do you think Wahhabis in London are going to start inviting ex-Muslims to
debate?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I'm going to make it happen.
And awesome. I got to say one thing. I actually think that there are a lot of ex-Muslims too on our part. And you know, we tend to, many ex-Muslims actually tend not to talk to Muslims. They tend to talk to like non-Muslim audiences, especially those in the West. It's very, that's why Armin and I, you know, when we did this year, we said that we wanted to reach out to more Muslims, and we have many coming up on the podcast, including from a range of conservative to progressive and everything. And I think that's really important. And I got to say one thing. I feel like we're transatlantic soulmates right now because I always get dinged for my optimism.
I have noticed how optimistic you are. Actually,
I have been. I mean, if you read my book, it's the same thing. I've done. I remember doing a TV show where the host asked me. It was here in Canada. It was a Canadian show, and he said that, you know, how do you feel? Have you gotten a lot of threats? Have you gotten everything? I'm like, yeah. Well, of course, you know, we've gotten threats, but I have to say, this is. I told him, I was like, there's more people listening to me now than I would have expected 5 or 10 years ago. Salman Rushdie had to go into hiding. I always give that example. And that was less than 3 decades ago. But you know, like, so I expressed a little bit of optimism. And I remember this one prominent Toronto progressive guy just called me up and said, how could you say that? You know, they're attacking me. They're doing this. I'm like, you know, I see you on street corners every day, like online, you know, tweeting and stuff like that. You're fine. We're walking around.
You're talking about relative to the past, right?
But relative to the past. But what I'm saying is that if we don't acknowledge the progress that we have made,
but can I
all this is for naught.
Go ahead. Rain on your parade.
Please do. I feel like I have...
But the thing is that you're talking about progress in London. We're talking about progress in Canada with Muslims in the United States, right? But if you look in other places, some people are like, seem like we're actually going backwards. If you look at Turkey, if you look at Malaysia, if you look at Indonesia, if you look at Bangladesh, if you look at Pakistan, I think, I'm not sure if we're just getting more news out of Pakistan or things are getting shittier in Pakistan. Some places where the people seem to be moving in the right direction are Iran and Saudi Arabia, even though the government is not, I don't know, very, but it seems like globally we're actually moving backwards.
Can I make a distinction between what governments are doing and what institutions are doing?
I was going to say the exact same thing. Go ahead.
I think it's never a bad thing when more people know that ex-Muslims exist in Muslim countries. And I think that can always be good. What's dangerous is when governments are sliding back, when institutions are sliding back, when media is sliding back. But I do think that even in Muslim countries, Muslims in those countries are learning that ex-Muslims exist. I have Muslim friends just across the world. I have friends, for example, from Saudi Arabia when I grew up, and I talked to them about ex-Muslim stuff, and they talk about how actually a lot of people just know in Dubai, for example, that they are ex-Muslims. Like, it's just something everyone knows about, right? But I do get your point about we are going sliding back. Bangladesh possibly was safer 5-10 years ago than it is now, right? For ex-Muslims, right? I get your point. And the more we collect, the more the ex-Muslims become kind of a dissenting force in these countries, the more the government's going to crack down and kill us.
There's multiple variables here too. So, you know, you're giving the example of Bangladesh. A lot of times a crackdown and the danger is because more of these people are coming out. Right. So that's also a factor. So it depends on how you want to look at it. If you want to look at, okay, more people are coming out and speaking out. I mean, Armin, just on this podcast, we've had open, non-anonymous ex-Muslims from Egypt. We've had them from Jordan. I mean, you see this, you see it on TV.
But actually, that's a very good example because atheism just became recently illegal in Egypt. Right.
It wasn't
illegal before.
And it's a terrorist offense in Saudi Arabia as well.
Terrorist offense before. So you're right. It's the governments are noticing atheism as a growing threat.
It's a backlash.
Is a reaction to it.
Right. Yeah. It's a backlash. And if you look at it as a backlash, here's an interesting thing about backlashes. Backlashes are terrifying when you look at the headlines. But when you look at the trend lines throughout history, backlashes are just symptoms of change happening. And backlashes are usually, you know, because they're symptoms, they're usually a sign. They forebode some kind of progress. I mean, you've never had any huge transformational change for the better, for the good happen without initial backlash. I mean, there's no example of that in history, whether it's a feminist revolution, whether it's civil rights, whether it's anything else. I mean, it's always been two steps forward, one step back. So even when I see these, I mean, a lot of these things are horrible. When I see them, it's always good to sort of, I think, zoom out and look at the big picture and think about the trend lines rather than just the headlines at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what scares me is, as much as I'd like to, I absolutely agree with what you're saying, Ali. Like, you know, we're at a tipping point. I think the world is, and I think that's irreversible, right? We're never, ever going to go back to the way we were. It's just that, like, it is a point that, you know, the backlash is human lives, like people that we probably know and can talk to, or ex-Muslims who will die, you know? Yeah.
Okay, to put things in perspective, though, you know, when I was in London, we went to this secular event, which was with Mariam Namazi. What was it called? Secular conference? And there was a lot of ex-Muslims in one place at the same time. And it was almost like half of ex-Muslim activists around the world were in one room, right? Mm-hmm. And I was sitting next to Sarah Hader, and I was like, Sarah, look at everybody in this room. This is half of the most active ex-Muslims around the world in one place. And this is the main force against Islam, right? Because there's nobody else that is doing it right. You have the bigots, you have the alt-right, you have, you know, And it's just us. This is it. This is all we have. And if you think about how small we are compared to the beast, the that is Islam. Imagine all the madrasas, all the funding of madrasas of Wahhabis and Iran spreading Shia and Indonesia spending money and Malaysia now become spending more money on Islam. We have this global giant and we are just this small little, and we're sitting here and thinking that we're going to be taking this down. And see, like,
the reason I first set up, so I have a charity program, Face to Faith. We work with like anyone who leaves religion, Jehovah's Witnesses, ex ultra Orthodox Jews, whatever, ex Muslims. And the reason I set up like that, and the reason I do the work the way I do is because I spoke to two guys who are gay lawyers.
By the way, on that note, please support us on Patreon if you want us to become bigger. But go on.
I would hardly do that. Right. So I spoke with these two gay lawyers back 5 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever, when I was first thinking about what I want to do with ex-Muslim stuff. And they said, Imtiaz, back in the day, my mum kicks me out on the street. And imagine gay people will always be a tiny minority of the population. Always. They're always going to be that. And there's always no real reasons for the majority to support them because it's just seen as this kind of very big taboo, even if it's non-religious.
Right? I see where you're getting at. That's a really good point.
So yeah. He was like, Imtiaz, what changed? He was like, look, I got kicked out by my mum when I was a teen, right? Now she's 80. I'll bring my partner who's gay into her house. She'll hug and kiss both of us and cook us food and love us. Right. What changed? He said, we came out en force. We took to the streets. We made it a political movement. We made it a social movement. We made it a civic movement. So for me, I don't give a shit that we're a minority within a minority because I think being small has certain advantages because we're basically considered to be like rapist pedophiles just by existing. Right. Like we're so scum. We're worse than that. Right. We are worse than that. But so we can only do better from that because we can only like what's
happening. That's of course you're optimistic. I wonder why is he so optimistic.
So we can only do better. That's what's happening.
I'm no pedophile too.
I'm not a murderer, rapist, pedophile anymore. I'm an ex-Muslim. People put me as part of this spectrum. I'm on the weird side. I'm on the evil side, but I'm still in the spectrum of what it means to be Muslim now. What's changed.
Your prophet is a rapist pedophile. That's not
But my point I'm trying to make is, look, LGBT people are by definition never a majority. They're never even a tiny minority. They're tiny, right? By definition. And they did it, right? They fucking did it.
Right.
What is stopping us to do as a tiny minority? It's not going to be, it's going to happen in, I swear to God, record this. In 10 years' time, right, ex-Muslims in the West, at least in the UK, it's going to be a lot more normalized, like to the point where I can go to anyone in the street and interview them and they'll be like, oh yeah, I don't care, right? There'll be at least a lot more of that happening 10, 15 years. Middle East, fuck knows. I don't know. Because Middle East, the gay thing is still a problem there, right?
Not just Middle East, the Far East as well. But I'm just... But this is a global battle. It's not just about London and, you know, and Vancouver.
We gotta win really hard in the West. We have to win really hard in the West because it's the only place that we can have our voices properly heard.
Right. Because
there's another thing. Whenever we talk about, this isn't the way that the world works and the way the communication works. It isn't... it also isn't that whole model of that we have to have it here, but then we also have to have it in all of these other countries. Usually what happens is when you have a feminist revolution in the West, people over there start opening up to feminist ideas, even though like they don't make progress as fast, but stuff starts happening there. When you have an educational revolution here, a civil rights revolution, ending of slavery in the West, people over in other places start doing it. So if usually now you have, I remember gay marriage was something that in Pakistan was like pedophilia. It was people used to think it was like when I was living there, it's like pedophilia. Now there's people are talking about same sex rights, same sex activists. There's all kinds of activism that's happening.
And what's very interesting
there,
what's very interesting is that they're using the history of Pakistan and that area, like the Hijra people, and you know, the sort of
the eunuchs. Yeah, you're right.
Right. They're using that language instead of kind of Western kind of civil rights
language. Got elected to government. A Hindu majority Dalit woman got elected to government.
It's crazy, man.
She beat so there is, again, for Armin and you know, to respond to Armin and to also all the audience. I mean, we're not by any means saying that suddenly, you know, Pakistan is okay with minorities or people are okay with ex-Muslims. That's not true. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of lives being lost. There's a lot of blood being shed. This is even this backlash is as bloody as anything. Mm-hmm. But there is, it's a symptom of progress. And I think that that's a really, really important thing to note.
I do think that, like, in the next 10 years, the main global ideological battle is going to be Christianity is going to be, like, insignificant. It's going to be Islam, secularism / atheism, and another third player in the game is going to be identity politics, racist, nationalist kind of groups, mm-hmm. and also maybe Hinduism as an offshoot of that, people that are mixing nationalism with the nationalism in India with the Hinduism ideology. I think these are going to be the main four players in the global. So I think the atheism group is going, the main force that they have against them, it's not going to be Christianity, it's going to be Islam. Mm. And I think that most people are not playing this game right, because for too long, everybody, like, conversation like ours were shut down, and these, you know, the racists and the bigots were the main players against Islam. Yeah. And what I'm noticing is that our bigger role in this game, ex-Muslims, is actually changing a lot of people's, the way they talk about Islam. Their tones are changing as well, because a lot of people that were against Islam, they when they wanted to find people to follow, they used to find these people that were the bigots, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But now they're seeing other ways of phrasing their opposition to Islam, and they're not even.
They're becoming nuanced. They're becoming nuanced, and they're moving away from anti-Muslims bullshit.
Even a lot of the leaders I noticed have been following and talking to Islam, I've noticed that they're borrowing stuff that we're saying. We're not against Muslims, we're against Islam.
Although I worry about that sometimes, because I know some of those people, even like I've met some of them types of people, and actually sometimes depends on the type of person. Sometimes they go in for what's vogue, right? I get your point.
But we don't know. Some of them might actually changing their views on it, and even the ones that are not changing, the fact that they're changing their tone about it, they're noticing.
It's important. Yeah, I agree. I completely agree.
We're having a huge influence on this battle. By the way, this whole racist thing is, for example, you mentioned a lot of people in Islamic countries are noticing ex-Muslims. In Iran, just I think 2 or 3 days ago, and then last week, the number one trending hashtag was one of the top trending hashtags. I don't know if it was number one. In Iran was Man Murtad Hassan, which means I'm an apostate.
Mm.
And that was trending in Iran, right? So
yeah,
and everybody in Iran noticed it, because they're like, this is not something, because it was trending, Muslims, people that don't give a shit about any of these conversations, this was what they were showing on everyone's feed. And it was a huge reaction to it. Like, people that were making fun of atheists responding to people that were making fun of atheists. But the fact is that everybody knew that in Iran, the atheists...
I love when they make fun of us.
It's actually pretty phenomenal what Armin's talking about. The recent... in Iran. And what Armin did was... Armin and Atheist Republic took the screenshots of those tweets and they translated them into English. And if you go to Richard Dawkins's Twitter timeline, he has retweeted Armin and all of those screenshots, and check it out. It really is something that's pretty remarkable. That actually moves me to, I guess, the next question I wanted to ask is that when we were talking about the, we're talking about anti-Muslim bigotry and so on. So you had this in school, you know, you said you have the t-shirt with you where they drew bombs and explosives. Mm-hmm. They called you a terrorist. They did all that. And then, that made you hold on to Islam more. And then until you grew older and you let it go. Now there is a, you know, obviously anti-Muslim bigotry is a bit of a resurgence of it in the West in general. It's actually on both sides. There's like Muslims and their bigotry and all that, you know, the terrorism and ISIS and everything, all that on the rise, lone wolf attacks and so on. And then on the, and then you have the, all of the, you know, the Muslim bans and the tribalism against Muslims. So how do you feel about that now that you've sort of, you've left Islam? How do you deal with that? How do you balance those two sides?
You know, on the extreme stuff, which is on both sides, there's a lady called Julie Ebner who's written a book on the far right and Islamist groups, and she calls it two sides of the same coin. And I think that's a very interesting way to think about it. That extremism on in the Islamic sense and extremism in the kind of far right or racist sense is two sides. They feed on each other. They use the same kind of language and rhetoric, and they often have the same people, you know, bouncing off each other. In terms of how I feel about it and whether that's changed, I think one thing I am quite aware of is when identity is used as cover for bad ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So I see this quite a lot where it's like, I'll give you an example, and this is a bit of an offshoot of an example, but you know when Grenfell Tower fell, the big tower in London that had a big fire and lots of people died? That's about half a mile from me, 1 kilometer from me. And I went there sort of the day after that. And what was really interesting is that there were activists there, like leftist activist type people often, or just normal people who were like, hey, this is messed up. We need to fight for it. And then one of the people took the megaphone and started shouting basically Islamist slogans like, this is, you know, a sign from Allah, you know, we've got to come together, Allahu Akbar. And there was like, it was all very culty, what? Actually. Yeah. I have a video of it from somewhere. It's all very culty. And actually, what was really interesting is actually some of the audience felt so, you could tell they're so uncomfortable because they can't do anything because they'd be seen as Islamophobic. But it's like, dude, this is like messed up. Like people have died and you're making this about your faith. Like what the hell, right?
Right.
And that kind of thing really troubles me. And I think when I was Muslim, I would have felt uncomfortable with it, but I wouldn't have really processed it in my mind properly because I'd be like, well, the people who died included Muslims. You know, the world is messed up. Islam is the right thing, so that's okay. You know, I'm a kind of thing. Now I'm very careful about that, about how people use that. So victims of, let's say, anti-Muslim hatred often get pulled in to buy nefarious organizations and sometimes charities who are trying to promote, let's say, Islamism, right? Mm-hmm. And they get pulled in, and I've seen this happen a lot. An example of that is with the families of extremists, right? They, I used to hear these stories from friends of mine who used to be sort of part of like, you know, anti-extremism stuff, which is that the families who might be quite liberal and their son became like an ISIS person or try to blow something up, they would have properest hardcore Islamists go to their house and talk to them and, you know, hold their hands and support them because they were used as rallying cries for their kind of Islamist narratives. And I'm very, very, very sensitive to that now. How are people using things for their own narratives? Because based on what you were saying just earlier, we get used for that as well. Like ex-Muslims, people will use our narratives as a way to defend their bullshit ideas, right?
Oh, yeah. We've talked about that a lot on this podcast.
I'm sure you have.
But that doesn't mean that we have to be that careful because, I mean, if we're telling the truth, we're telling the truth. People will use whatever they want for whatever.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. So I do not, for example, that much, almost at all, actually, say, oh, don't take this to be right wing. I don't give a shit about that because at the end of the day, if you're going to be right wing and you...
People tell me that I should not say something, even if it's true, because it's playing into the narrative of.
I agree. Yeah.
You
exactly.
Agree? You agree
They're wrong. They're obviously wrong. Right. Yeah, okay. The point I'm trying to make is it's something to be aware of because, those people are very nefarious and they don't look for people like me, you and Ali, who were switched on about how people use things as game playing. Right. It doesn't mean that we have to go out and go, don't take my ideas for yourself. What I'm talking about is when you've got like just normal non-activist people who go through something, they get groomed and they go, or not groomed, but they get brought into these kind of ideas. And I've seen that happen.
They don't just get co-opted. So Armin, we're used to that. We're like, okay, we're going to say what we want to say. We don't really care. But, if people want to use it, that's out of our control. And that's happened to all of us. But there's some people who actually think, well, these people are giving me a lot of support, right? Mm-hmm. Like I hear Breitbart's really giving me a platform over here, but all these leftists are rejecting me. So, you know, I'm just going to take this Islam issue. I'm going to forget about everything else. All of the other things, the rationality and the, you know, the civil rights and the climate change and the science and all of it. And I'm just going to go with there because I'm getting support from there. And they're very good at that. So that is something that is,
I understand the distinction. But if you go on their platform, you could actually, you have, what you do is you take a jab at Christianity. You also mention the
You're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm not talking about us going on there. Like we would go on their platform. No. I've been featured on Breitbart. You've been on The Rebel. You know, this has happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we know what to do with that platform. We know how to do. We're very conscious of it. And I think that's what Imtiaz was saying too. But we're talking about people who are not necessarily conscious of that, who go there. They're like, I like these people. I'm going to join them. Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm going to join them because they're giving me support.
And I feel bad for those people because it's not their, like, really.
It's not their fault.
They feel very lonely when everybody's ignoring them. And as soon as somebody gives you a little bit of attention, these are my friends.
Yeah. That shows you how much of this is really about community. A lot of times.
Yes, it really is. Exactly. I mean, like, we talk a lot about kind of, you know, like, it is, you know, I think ex-Muslims today, because we have communities, because we have this kind of online and offline communities that we can be part of, they're less likely to be vulnerable to that kind of bullshit. Mm. But I absolutely understand why people went that direction, because no one supported us. Like, no one did, right? Like, no one gave a shit about us.
Yeah, so we had to make our own platform and our own podcast.
Yeah. And I see this with the far left as well. Like, the far left are so good at taking something that's happened, right? Bringing people in and being like, oh yeah, you know, like they treat you like scum, like join us, right?
Right.
And they make you think that, you know, oh, if you fight for the rights of pro-Palestinians, it'll make your life better. Or if you fight the right for the life of the Palestinians, you might have never met a Palestinian in your life. You might not even know what it looks like on a map, right? Mm-hmm. But they kind of build these narratives that this is what you need to do to make your life better, which was shit at some point. And right. it's a grooming process. And I see that in every single group. Like, it's not about ex-Muslims left or right. It's the same shit everywhere. It's from anti-Muslim people towards other. So they go to like white working class people and they go, oh, your life is very bad. Oh, you're seeing this stuff in the media. I mean, they're noticing real problems. So you might see like, oh shit, there's loads of like Islamists in my area. Holy shit. How did that happen? Right.
Like, yeah.
Or, you know, and then they go to those people and they go, well, I have a solution for you. I have a fantastic ideology that you can be part of, which are full of people that you can feel like a community with, who feel anger in the same way and will direct your anger in this political direction. So it's the same shit over and over again.
You know, but I haven't noticed that they have been very successful with ex-Muslim. Like, a lot of people accuse ex-Muslims of like all of a sudden becoming too right-wing and people say, well, we didn't have a home, so that's why they went right-wing. But I noticed that the ex-Muslims that did went on right-wing platforms, most of them didn't. They just used them, their platform, and they didn't actually adopt their ideology.
I would say that's a new thing, though, Armin. I would say that's because ex-Muslims don't need to feel alone anymore.
No, I mean, because most ex-Muslims, when they look at Islam, they're like, okay, this is homophobic, this is that. And when they go on right-wing media and they sometimes notice that they're saying the same kind of bullshit, they're like, yeah, this is a bullshit that I was running away from.
Sure.
Yeah, the majority of ex-Muslims tend to be very liberal. They tend to have their head straight. They understand that anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Muslim hate is bullshit. But there is a small, there is a minority, and they're a very vocal minority, especially on Twitter and some of these social platforms, who tend to align with some of the right wing. I mean, it's not something that...
Well, right wing or far left as well.
Far left or far
right. By the way, let's not, when we're talking about the far right, not just, we're not talking about everybody right wing, because...
I'm very interested by right-wing ex-Muslims because I can have a conversation with them about ideas that I might not agree with.
We're not really defining what we mean here, because right now right-wing has been, a lot of people are basically using right-wing as racist bigots.
Yeah. But right-wing for me are, far-right for me are like sort of veering towards the territory of kind of a bit fascisty, a bit neo-Nazi, where kind of the ideas are
which
very much
weird because that's a leftist thing to be used. Fascistic government control stuff used to be
now we're talking about tariffs, right? Like, I mean, come on, like the whole thing is merged. But here's what's the reason I think that that's happening a lot, and I agree with you, Armin, I think it's wrong, is because the mainstream right at this moment is Trump's party in the U.S. And a lot of the old establishment, what used to be the right wing, like, you know, right. the David Frums and the Buckleys and the Kissingers and everything, even if you disagreed with them, that is now sort of rejected. The establishment has been rejected. So now that your mainstream right actually are people like Marine Le Pen, are people like Donald Trump, because they're in positions of power, that in Austria, the party that got 46% of the vote in Austria that was founded by a Nazi, right? I mean, this kind of thing, because of
where we come from, the right is the Islamic right? And I actually mentioned that one time, and the left are the champ. You know, in the United States, they see the left as people that are now are PC culture, they don't want free speech. But where we come from, the left are the champions of free speech.
And the right are the people
that don't want free speech. And I mentioned that people are like, oh, what are you talking about, Armin? Left and right is a United States thing. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? That
is basic politics 101.
As a child, I remember we talked about left wing, right wing in Iran.
Iran has Iran had a whole bunch of exiled communists from
South Asia. It was the same thing. Like a lot of my uncles and a lot of, there were actually a lot of open atheists in the 60s and 70s in Pakistan. It was considered a cool thing because it was such a communist.
In Iran, they killed 30,000 of them in a very short amount of time.
Yeah,
that's the difference. But what's the atmosphere like in London right now? When it comes to talking about Islam, because Lauren Southern was just recently kicked out of the UK.
Can you explain who Lauren Southern is, just for the audience? People don't. I don't know who she is, so that's what I'm asking.
She's that sort of
Yeah, she's like a right-wing political commentator, and she was going to, along with two other people that most people don't know, were going to go to UK to talk to Tommy Robinson, and they were arrested. Two of them were detained for 3 days. Lauren was kicked out. She was just left at the border with it was really weird actually when she explained the story. But a lot of people hate her because a lot of people do consider her alt-right. But whether you like her or hate her, the fact is that she didn't have a right to speak to a lawyer because they took her as under the Terrorist Act. So, but this is a person that is. By the way, James is actually mentioning that she's from Syria. Oh wow. That's basically right next to Vancouver, where I'm from. But she was basically held because of her opinions as a threat to the UK and then kicked out. And this is a Canadian citizen. And a lot of people were shocked because there's a lot of other people from Islamic countries that are welcomed without that much scrutiny to UK, but this person was kicked out because of her political opinions. And a lot of people think that UK is really turning into one of the things that they did that with
Ann Coulter too, didn't they?
I don't know, here's the thing. I was like, maybe Lauren actually did something more extreme that I'm not aware of. It's not just opinions, but they actually gave the reason that she's being a racist. And that an example that they gave was a picture of her holding a sign that says Allah is gay. I didn't know Allah was Arab because I didn't know, but it is weird. It's really weird. What's happening in the UK? And are you afraid that you're not going to be able to talk about Islam in the future?
I have no worry about that because British citizens are kind of treated a bit differently. And also, if they did that, it would be great PR for ex-Muslims. So good luck with that.
Lauren benefits and everybody is now checking
out. Well, I was just going to say, all this did was it just gave more.
Yeah.
I don't know that much. I'm not that familiar with their platform. I kind of like the whole Allah is gay thing. But because I know Mariam and Mariam Namazi and everything held up those signs at the Jimmy, Pride Parade as well. Jimmy, however,
yeah, Jimmy did that. Jimmy's
badass.
Jimmy Bangash, yeah. So, and who is going to be on the podcast, by the way, soon. Yeah. So just wanted to announce that. But the I think we're just kind of, what you've done is that even if her views were completely bullshit, you've completely legitimized them and you've made her a free speech martyr. And you've given her status that she may not deserve.
You know, I think I take the view that, like, look, I believe that a lot. No, so to clarify, one of the points is that actually, no, there have been many Islamists who've been cut. Zakir Naik is banned from the UK, I think, unless I'm wrong.
Yeah, but this guy, for the thing that he said is actually against people, against killing or prosecuting people. It wasn't, I mean, correct me, people, if I'm wrong, but Learn Certain has so far not said anything. I mean, she has ideas that you might disagree with, but she has not said anything against people.
So I would draw a distinction between, for example, Zakir Naik, who has straight up said these people need to be murdered, and Lawrence Southern. I agree with that. I think there are also some Islamists who've been rejected, who probably have. Do you know what? Most of them would have actually said something about, like, kill the apostates. So I don't know. But I do think that they're going to come down harder on sort of more alt-right and far-right people, because it's politically easier to do that in the UK. It's harder to kick people out who are Islamists, who are kind of saying, you know, murder X number of people. Because
I don't even think they should keep them out. I think you should let it. There's a big difference between saying that my belief is that we should kill, you know, this is apostate, should be killed under an Islam. If someone is saying that, that's very different from someone telling somebody. And this is a legal definition. There's a legal definition between saying, hey, this could happen to you. Versus, I'm going to do this to you.
I have to be honest. I'm still very stuck on what I think about this area, because, like, Mohammed Sayed, I have had a long conversation with him about this.
I think he might agree with me on this.
He agrees with you. He's got a very strict.
Can you explain to me? I don't know your opinions.
Oh, so what I'm saying.
No, wait. Let me. MTS was saying. I want to say.
Oh, okay. I thought you were asking me.
No.
Both. So Mohammed Sayed Ali, if I'm right, your view is that it has to be specifically someone saying that person needs to be killed or whatever it is, right?
Like, that's US law as well. That's the US law,
exactly. Anything above and beyond that is freedom of speech protected, right?
Now, so that's if I say ex-Muslims need to be hunted down and killed, but I don't mention anybody specifically, that shouldn't be illegal?
No, that's not illegal. The time it would be illegal is if you said something.
I'm not saying if it's illegal, right? I'm asking if it should be illegal.
I don't think it should be. I don't think it should be. I think it would be illegal. It should be illegal if you say, go out, I want you guys to go out and start hunting and killing ex-Muslims. I think that should be illegal. But I think that if somebody is just saying that we think that ex-Muslims should be targeted, and they should be, I mean, they're essentially saying that. So you might be right, depending on how you phrase it. But no, I don't think, I think expressing a view that someone should be killed versus...
I think you have to remember that Europe has a specific history with Nazism. And the killing of the Jews, and I think that's where a lot of these distinctions between us.
But Europe, they should remember their longer history, because Europe also has a history with Islam. Almost invaded entire Europe. They just don't remember it.
Yeah, but we're talking about, like, in terms of speech, right? And Europe also has a history of the Enlightenment. So we got, but the point is that I think when it comes to free speech, an example is, I may have given this example before, is that when the South Park creators were threatened by a 9/11 celebrating group in New York that included, they were basically fundamentalist Muslims, they had put up a picture of Theo Van Gogh. You know, Theo Van Gogh, who was stabbed to death for making that film Submission with Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And they put up a picture and they said that, you know, you should really be careful what you do because this could happen to you. And the question was that a threat? And according to U.S. speech laws, that was not a threat. That was their right to free speech. Yeah. It would have been a threat if they said, see, what this is what we're going to do to you. Or if they said, everybody should do that. That becomes incitement to violence. Yeah. But it's a very, very strict
you're saying you're not worried about, but aren't you worried about the direction that the UK is going? It seems like if they're They're I mean, are you saying, I agree with you, they don't, for example, Tommy Robinson, they can't kick him out, he's a citizen, but they still, the police does constantly harass him and visit him.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm not saying that you guys, anybody that is here, so I'm going to get a lot of shit for this because people will be like, oh, you're defending Tommy Robinson. Even if you disagree with him, I don't think you should get constantly
visited by the cops. I specifically disagree with Tommy Robinson. On every level, I've met him. I know. I've seen him when he was in the EDLA and left. Yeah, I really don't like the guy. I don't like the guy. But what's been happening to him is not right. Whether it's by the police or whether it's by people attacking on the street, both of that is quite scummy. Because and it's counter fucking productive. Like all you're doing is empowering exactly the narrative that he's making. Right, like.
No, but they wanted to get off on it. Did you see that thing with Michael Cernovich? He was like holding this. He's like, "Look, I'm being harassed. I'm being harassed." Yes. The video goes viral. Like no, they want Antifa to show up at their
We know
protests.
This works for them. We know that this backfires. Right?
Yeah.
But my question is that what's happening to the UK? Is this worse and worse?
It is. And it's a bit like Facebook. You know where Facebook is now in a trap where because they've kind of started deciding what is and isn't acceptable, and they kind of, there's a lot of things with ex-Muslims, for example, being banned from Facebook. Every so often I'll just see another ex-Muslim activist going, oh, I'm not on Facebook anymore. And I think similarly in Britain, we've trapped ourselves because we don't have the strict line on free speech, and because we're getting more and more vague about what Islamophobia is, right? It's curtailing the freedom of speech from a lot of people, including probably at some point Muslims. Like Shias have a lot to say about Abu Huraira, for example, or, you know, Aisha, right? Is that like, if that, you know, kicks off, what is that then? Is that, should that person be kicked out from the UK? I don't know. So I think like, it's getting more difficult, I think, for the UK to figure out who they should and shouldn't shut down. And I think that's only a problem. And it's a big problem in politics today with sort of, you know, safe space type stuff at university. But at the same time, Armin, I would say that actually a lot of the population is getting sick to death of hearing about freedom of speech being curtailed at university and in the country level. Because we don't, you know, it's one of the few things that the right wing and the Muslims can agree on. Like Muslims want.
But this is going to get right. This is what got Trump into power. This PC culture that the government has is going to eventually bring a right wing government or something like that.
Yeah, I agree.
This right wing government is going to steal the anti-Islam narrative away from people like us. And it's going to destroy, they already have in the United States, and it's going to happen even more. You know, this PC culture, people are responsible for the rise of the alt-right. But Ali is mentioning that we have little time, so I just want James to ask a question regarding the UK grooming gang scandals. James is a patron in the live chat. Thanks, James. Do you want to quickly address that? And then after that, we want to talk about some of your work.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I know a little bit about stuff like that.
Telford. I think Telford, he says the Telford news.
Yeah. So Telford is a very it happens in areas where you get very poor Asian communities, like Southeast Asian communities, like, you know, Pakistani communities, and sometimes Sikh as well, but generally it's sort of very Pakistani and Indian, and it is, you know, in a big way, there's a lot of involvement of sort of people from a Muslim background, or at least from a Pakistani or Asian background, and a lot of that is to do with how the narratives of the white person, and especially the white girl, goes around our community. So you're taught from a young age that white people are colonizers, and this kind of narrative, which is not entirely untrue. There's a lot of history of these kind of diasporic communities.
Everybody has been a colon. Everyone's people has at one point been a colon.
Absolutely. But this is one of the most recent, in terms of historical consciousness, this is one of the the most recent.
I don't know. The most recent thing is that white people end up ending colonization. So they are the ones that ended the trend.
Ended is a strong word.
That's a little too. I think that's too simple.
I'm just trying to offend some people.
I know. White people also ended slavery. Remember, yes. They ended after for years and years.
Here's the thing. I'm just gonna say slavery was a thing until white people decided that it shouldn't be a thing. Go on. All right.
Okay, there you go. I get the point.
The thing that my point is that, like, look, every different community or whatever it is has a view about their position in counter to something else, right? And I think I've seen a lot of this kind of thing where we live in these kind of very, like, Britain is a very white country, right? It is, and a lot of the narrative is kind of us against them, and, you know, and some of that is grounded and some of it is not grounded, and sometimes it's religious and political leadership in our communities that it's in their value to say, yeah, look, those people are like this, right? So in mosques, they'll say, look at these white girls going around naked. Like, that's such a common trope, right? Look at these white girls going naked, sleeping with everyone, blah, 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 these street, you know, they use really, really, really sexist language. Now, you grew up with that when you were going to mosque from the age of 6, from the age of 7, and you're hearing that every single khutbah, every Friday for 52 weeks, right? 52 weeks, you do the maths, right? What is going to happen to that child's brain? Now, most people, almost every Muslim, will look at what's happening in childhood and go, what the hell, that's disgusting, right? But what it is that these narratives are mechanisms for these kind of quite scummy people to defend what they're doing. So if people are raping people, for example, they will draw narratives in their head about why this is comfortable, right? Now, this is one of the narratives. And the problem is that this kind of narrative around white girls, that they are white working class girls, it's a working class thing, by the way. It's never upper class white girls. It's always working class, right? That they're sort of on the street, they're naked, you know, they're vulnerable, they're easy to get to, right? That narrative becomes like a meme almost, right? That some of these very scummy people use. So it is a problem. And one of the biggest problems is that we do not talk about this. There was a very interesting BBC documentary done by a Pakistani guy who was like, this is a documentary about how we need to fucking deal with this. This is a problem. We can't deny it, right? The statistics are there. Like, math does not lie to you, right? There is X number of percent of people who are from Muslim
background. In Rotherham, wasn't it the case that there were over 1,000 girls that were abused, like white girls that were abused?
That's the tip of the ice. Like, that's not even like.
The point is the cops didn't do anything because cops didn't want to be seen as racist. Like, they knew, but they didn't, because there were these minority groups, mainly Pakistanis from Muslim backgrounds who were doing this.
I mean, this is not all just hyped up.
No, it isn't, because the stats are not going to lie to you, right? And I'll give you an example of this. There's a couple of honor violence charities in the UK. My favorite is called Karma Nirvana. They are small, but they're very effective. The girl who set it up, she ran away from an honor violence situation when she was 16. She's now like a MBE or a OBE, sorry, and she's fantastic. And they, when they first started, like 10, 15 years ago, whatever, they were called coconuts and traitors and native informants and whatever, race traitors, because they were saying that the Sikh communities and the Muslim communities, in some extent, but Pakistani, Sikh, and whatever, had problems with honor violence. So in the same way as they are getting told, you shouldn't talk about this because it's feeding racism, right? The grooming gram stuff is the same thing repeated again, where it's like, we shouldn't talk about this because we might offend people. And, you know, these communities already face a lot of issues. Let's not make it worse. Like, it's disgusting, because what you're saying is that this disgusting behavior essentially is inherent to this community. Well, fuck off, you racist scum. It isn't inherent. It is a problem in these communities because of certain memes and ideas.
It is a bit inherent, isn't it?
Well, sorry. It's not inherent to every person from that community. There are memes and ideas in those communities that are bad that lead to making this much more acceptable.
It's not in their DNA. It's not like they're
programmed to. You know what I mean? I'm not going to go and fucking, like, you know, groom like some nine, like, it's not.
Imtiaz, the question is, do you think it is a religious thing, or do you think it's a cultural thing, or it's because of the historical narrative about colonization, or is it a religious thing? Because I think Tommy Robinson would argue that a lot of it is religious based.
Tommy Robinson is wrong, because honor violence, like Karma Nirvana, they deal with Sikh honor violence just as much as they deal with Muslim honor violence, right? Mm. And I think this
when it comes to Islam, you can't tell. You can't tell exactly. when culture starts and
religion ends. It's just that's a sociological question, right? Like everything in sociology, you can always look at how multivariate is. But I will say that there are specific problems with in-group and out-group stuff within Islam, where we say the kuffar are X, Y, Z. And then culturally, we've taken that in as diaspora and said, not only that, but yeah, it's white people and, you know, we are better and it's, you know, white people are being and, you know.
And a lot of people
talk,
about culture as if it's always better than religion. Culture could be as disgusting or worse than religion.
Hindu nationalists can be atheists. Hindu nationalists are not always religious, you know?
Well, I mean, this is what we say about...
Culture could be dogmatic and it could be very barbaric and sometimes some cultures need to die. And in fact, you know, as long as you're using either culture or religion to figure out what's the best thing to do, you're going to do some shitty things instead of using your reasoning and using some what did my ancestors used to do or what my society tells me to do instead of just thinking about things. Basically, culture is acting in the same exact way as religion. Who cares? I mean, I care, but whether it's culture or religion, it's a shitty meme that needs to die.
Yeah, because you know, and usually I'm more interested in why someone is asking me the question: is it culture or religion, right? So if someone is asking me that because they want me to say they want me to say it's religion, and then they can say, actually, you know, what about culture? And they give me stats, but and then if I say it's culture as well, if I say it's culture and religion, people who are anti-religious can say, no, it's definitely religion, right? But it's like, no, it's complicated, and the point is, you can definitely look at Islam and go, that has caused problems that have led to the grooming scandal. You can say that, right? But you cannot say it's only Islam. It's only Pakistani culture. It's only Bangladesh. It's because it isn't, right? It's as simple as that.
I quoted a Reddit user on this in my book about the cultural religion thing. And then he said something like, it's about a plane crashing. He's like, well, it wasn't about the plane that crashed. It's about the ground that hit it.
Sure.
That is the distinction between culture and religion. I thought it was a great way to put it.
And then, you know, a lot of people, when they say, oh, is this terrorism? Is it politics? Is it religion? Is it economy? And it's kind of like talking about a car. Like, is it the wheels? Is it the engine? Is it the gas? Take any of those away and the car is not going to move forward. Like, it's a mix. Yeah.
That's why I think, Armin, you know, when you said that, you know, the three main conflicts and stuff that we're going to have, you narrated them. And I think that makes a lot of sense. One of the things I think is just going to be tribalism versus non-tribalism. People who cling to their birth identities that they didn't work to earn, like, you know, race, nationality, all that, versus people who have their earned identities as, you know, the achievements that they've made. And a lot of that has to do also with the technology, like how many people are left behind by technology, how many. Right. And I think that this is a problem on both sides. You have identity politics on the left, you know, when it comes to minorities and all that, fetishizing all of their ridiculous views just because they're minorities. On the other hand, on the right, you have nationalism and Judeo-Christian heritage. And, you know, we're from Europe and, you know, white identitarianism is not racist. And so all this, it's actually, and that may even be more toxic. So
I'm more scared of groups actually in some ways, and like group things
like the tribalism is actually one of the biggest problems. So
and like, you know, like
this is why I celebrate the disagreements among ex-Muslims and atheists. A lot of people are like, oh, the atheist community is so divided, we can't agree on everything. A great thing if we all agree on everything. Then we have cult.
I posted something on Facebook which is a little bit like leftist on my public profile, and this ex-Muslim said, it's just, how did you share this? You know, I'm going to unfollow you. I'm crying, like, you know, I thought you were... I was like, mate, I'm not like a fucking perfect human being. I will have ideas that are shit or will change.
I get that all the time. Let them unfollow you. Regressive, Imtiaz. You're such a regressive... Majid Nawaz gets called a regressive leftist now, even though he coined the fucking term.
It's just amazing.
It's hilarious.
It's so much fun. It's so much fun being...
It is fun.
let's talk about your work. You make some amazing videos and documentaries. Some of the videos I love is that the one that you made about slavery, and then you made another one, but you go into such level of detail. Slavery is, by the way, if we should link to that, anybody that hasn't watched that video should go watch that. And
let me make
the way Imtiaz talks about it, what I like about it is that he cannot not be taken seriously. by any, because a lot of Muslims, when they come and look at exposure, like, oh, these people don't understand this and that. But the amount of nuance and the amount of detail that MTS goes through in explaining like different things in Islam in his videos, even if the most serious Muslims, even they disagree with him, they can't claim that he didn't do his homework. They will have some respect for the amount of detail that he put in his work. But so that's some of the work that he does on different topics. And you should do more, by the way. So far,
yeah, there's so time. Much.
I know.
All my patrons have raised, they're so mad at me with the patron. I took 6 months between that video. I just don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, like all this stuff I do is voluntary, so I don't get money for it. So
you should make your Patreon account. Another thing you did was the Vice documentary. That was fantastic. You went and
the Vice documentary on Xmas. I remember seeing it. I was so happy to see that. I have, because you know, you see these things here and there on these other shows. When I saw it on Vice, and I was like, "Wait, this is a really, really well known thing." It was so gratifying just to see that documentary. So yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, people are asking, you know, Sayed is asking on the live chat, when are we going to see a new video on your channel?
I have actually filmed everything with my friend. I've got loads of stuff.
What's the next
I
just topic? Need to,
it's actually on the Assyrians and the language, what's the language called? My brain is like 1 a.m., 2 a.m.
What's the channel's name?
Salsala. But that's basically my kind of, let's look at nerdy stuff around pre-Islamic Arabia and Islam, because I'm obsessed with like Islam. I love reading about Islam and Islamic history and academic stuff as well, right?
It's so much fun after you leave it, isn't it?
It's so much fun.
Because it's so interesting after you leave it, yeah.
Islam is so much fun if you don't believe in it.
It's actually more fun. Like, and this is the thing.
Christianity. That's one thing that we're talking to Ibrahim about. Ibrahim's like, it's more developed. It's like a more intelligent. I was thinking about that a lot. I'm like, yeah, you're.
Yeah, I like to tell Muslims, you have no idea how amazing your religion is.
And you know what? I think it really scares people. Like, it really scares Muslims actually, because like my interest in Islam, which is, I do think it's really pure because it comes from like, I love reading this stuff. I'm obsessing about it. Like, and when I talk to them about it, you can tell like, they're like, oh shit, I did not sign up for this. I did not sign up for him to tell me about how, you know, Layla's been whatever, you know.
Da, da, da. No, I mean, when they talk about it, you're talking about like, oh, God wants you to do this. I mean, this and that and this, this is how, this, the way they talk about it is the most boring fucking shit ever. If you look at the Quran, at the Quran as a guidebook, is the shittiest guidebook that you can ever come up with. But if you look at it as a historic book and you're trying to solve puzzles, or where did this come from? Oh, they borrowed this from there. Or this sounds exactly like the sticks that they got from there.
I'll give you an example. Like Jahannam comes from the word Gehenom, which is a word in Jewish from the valley of Hinnom. It's crazy. It's like Jahannam.
Like Salam and Shalom.
Do you know what's super interesting? So we filmed a piece on the Himyarites, which are a Yemeni Jewish kingdom that no one knows about. And the last king of it was called Dhul-Nuwas, which means Lord of the King of the Locks, because he had the side locks because he was Jewish. Now, they existed 200 years before Muhammad, 300 years before Muhammad. And you can see motherfucking like inscriptions that say Bismillah ar-Rahman, like what the fuck, right? Himyarite tablets, and they've got, you can read like, it's Bismillah ar-Rahman. They were using ar-Rahman 300 years before, because
you need to provide a link to this, because I'm going to put that in the description.
Yeah, the Bismillah. Yeah.
I need to edit it.
Okay. So whenever you have it ready, but you know, it's even more, it goes even further back. The Brahma was the sort of the superior spirit in Hinduism. Right. And Ur, there's a city, and I think in Iran called Ur, and that's supposed to be the origin of Abraham's father in the Old Testament. And Ibrahim actually comes from Brahma, the Brahmin, you know, that Hindu thing. So there's Far East influence there too. And if you look at the story of Abraham and Sarah in the Torah or in the Old Testament, it's very similar to Brahma and Saraswati.
Oh, Sayed is saying the language you were talking is, did you mean Syriac?
Syriac, yes.
Syriac, yeah.
But
precursor language. Precursor language, the Quran, by the way.
Did you read the Christoph Luxembourg's the origin Syria, the Syro-Aramaic routine when he talked about
it's
how...
It's not Syriac, it's Aramaic, sorry. It's Aramaic, actually.
Oh, it's Aramaic. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, I said it by accident. But Syriac and Aramaic actually kind of went together.
Yeah. Do you guys know Bart Ehrman?
Vaguely. Yeah, he's an academic. He's quite a well-known academic.
He's a biblical scholar, used to be Christian. He does a lot of... He writes amazing detective work on the Bible, and he's like a leading scholar.
Yeah.
And that kind of work hasn't been done on the Quran and the Hadith because most of the scholars on Islam are Islamic scholars, and obviously they're extremely biased, right?
Or the German.
So there's some really good German ones, yeah.
There are, but they're not as, I mean, they exist, but not as much as the amount of secular academic analysis that has been done on the Bible.
A lot of his funding as well, like where the funding comes from.
They asked Bart Ehrman, would he ever analyze the Quran? And he said, whenever I'm tired of living. Because it was afraid of the backlash, but I think because of the reaction you might get from actually analyzing this, where's the source of Allah? Where did Allah come from? Right? If you analyze that, you're gonna get a lot of back. I mean, think about it. In the UK, if you're an academic, do you actually want to write a paper on this? Probably not, right?
What's really interesting because I've gone to a lot of these Islamic studies. So I used to go to this School of Oriental and African Studies, which is like a very sort of it's focused on stuff like this. And they have the Center for Islamic Studies, which is run by one of the guys who was a translator. He's got his own translation of the Quran, Muhammad something, right? And so it would be literally me and like six other people in some of their Wednesday lectures, because we're all nerds. And for example, like some very famous speakers went there. But what's really interesting is because they're kind of their funding is dodgy, but because no one gives a shit about it, they're allowed to be nerdy within their own space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So
you have to dig for the really good shit.
Yeah, but they can be nerdy about the very nuanced stuff, but they can't come out and be like, we think Muhammad might have not been real. Or like, is there, you know, or maybe this is where Allah came from.
Otherwise you end up being like Patricia Crone. Patricia Crone is the biggest person in the space who said she's passed away, who said, is Muhammad even real, right? So she wrote like books like Hagarism, and she's from Germany. But that's true. But more and more I'm seeing, because academics are basically agreeing that, hey, maybe the Hadiths are actually all bullshit, right? It's creating this kind of push away, because there's been a revival, especially because Patricia Crone, that is pushing academics away. And I'll give you an example of this. I was reading this very obscure paper on Hadith, and it was written by a Muslim guy. Like I met him when he was Muslim, and it was very interesting. In the paper was that he was going, oh, it's very interesting. The earlier Hadith, like the Musnad Ahmad by Imam so late at night, like the first one, the Musnad. Oh, they're very vague and they've got no like dates and stuff. And actually a lot of them are considered fake. And it's only the ones 200 years later that are like, the prophet said this on this date and even this time to this minute, you know, like he was like, it's so weird. And this Muslim guy was going, I think that's because they just made that up later because it helped their tribes. And he was talking about how
he talking about the Sahih Hadith or just on...
No, he was talking about the key books, like the Muslim and the Ahmad. Okay. Yeah, like, you know, Bukhari and all that. Now what, the other thing he was saying that was very interesting, and this you love this as the ex-Shia here, Armin, is he was saying how the Hadith...
Ali is also ex-Shia.
That's okay.
Okay. You both... You're all ex-Shias. What he was saying in this paper was, what's very interesting is what Hadith were promoted by what families. So for example, if you're a family that supported Ali, and if you're a family that didn't, if you're a family that supported Ali, you'd be like, Abu Talib was great and, you know, he loved Muhammad and really helped him. But if you didn't support Ali, you couldn't cuss out Ali because it's a bit dodgy to do that. What you would say is you would promote a Hadith going, and Abu Talib never converted to Islam, so his brain is going to boil in hell, right? So how Hadith got promoted...
Or Aisha.
Or his feet will always be in the fire. That's the one.
Exactly.
As a Shia, when I became an ex-Muslim, I was very surprised how much Sunnis love Aisha, because we hate Aisha.
Oh, we love her. Aisha was the mother figure. Yeah.
Mother of the faithful. Like,
it's this purity thing. It's this virginity thing. It's this kind of like, you know,
that's our Fatima.
Yeah, she's kind of like Yoko Ono, right? Like, it's a very divisive figure, you know. People,
your female deity was very assertive and strong. Our female deity was very like small and soft spoken. And
what? Who? Fatima or Aisha?
Fatima. Like, you know, I see Aisha as Fatima as female deities because all ancient religions need the female deity.
Yeah, they need the female figure.
That's why the Catholics made Mother Mary holy. That's why Sunnis made Aisha very big, and that's why she has made Fatima very big, right? But because Sunnis always want to be strong, Aisha was also very a strong figure
during the battle. That's very interesting.
Because she has her role as weak and weird oppressed, Fatima was always very soft-spoken. She was.
See, I always had Fatima in my head as this kind of like, yeah, she's there. Okay, cool. And so there are another 13 wives who are also there.
There's another German academic who wrote a paper that was actually really fascinating, where he talked about how when Muhammad talked about the, you know, the inheritance rights for daughters and things like that, a lot of that had to do with Fatima, and he had named Fatima the successor, but there was the whole battle that happened afterwards as they quashed that. So when Fatima was killed afterwards, you know, by, you know, the whole thing with Omar opening the door and everything. So a lot of it was because the descendancy was going to be to a woman and they didn't want that. So the caliphs and the imam, including Ali, they ended up quashing.
Omar killed our Fatima. Your second fucking caliph killed our
Fatima. I gotta be honest. I gotta be, even as a Muslim, I was like, whoa, that Omar guy is a bit of a dickhead. Like, no Sunni really likes Omar.
That's why it got so. Omar is the reason. I mean, that expansion of Islam within just a few decades.
Yeah, Omar. Yeah.
Yeah, Omar. If it wasn't because of Omar,
Spain, all the way to Omar. Yeah,
so I think
Osman, he did that without the internet. He did that without airplanes, without the printing press.
See, Omar and Osman together are the Constantine of Islam.
Yeah.
Osman, because he canonized the Quran, just like Constantine canonized the Bible. And Omar, because he's responsible for spreading Islam and making it the main religion, just like
Constantine. You know what? Well, I was always very interested in, because I grew up, you know, watching like The Message. I don't know if you remember that documentary.
Oh, like, I loved it. I remember watching and I was like, wow.
Obsessively. Yeah. And you know, like, even in that, Khalid bin Walid, who's the sword of, you know, he's not the sword, he's the, you know, he's the sword of Allah. Yeah. So he's this general who even Western scholars will kind of study him for his military tactics and stuff. Very interesting guy. And the relationship between Umar, his cousin, and Khalid bin Walid, have you read anything about that? It's so interesting. They hated each other. Umar hated him because he was so jealous that Khalid was getting so much success.
This is the fun thing even about the Quran, is like when you actually read through it and then you read the context and the tafsir, and the more you dig in, the more you realize how much of a soap opera it is. It's like stuff where he's like, he's like saying stuff to his wives. Okay, he's like, you know, well, I kind of want to marry my daughter-in-law, but my son's a doctor.
And Aisha. Yeah.
The funniest part is when Muhammad gets Aisha to admit that she was following him, and Muhammad's like, I already knew because Gabriel was following you, and Gabriel told me that you were doing this. Like, you know, it's like mothers opera. Tell me that if you don't tell me, I already know because a little bit.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah. No, it's like there's actually a hadith where Aisha goes, after Muhammad, something about his wives, and there's a revelation revealed. She goes, isn't that curious? Like, God always gives you a revelation that's good for you.
She was so fucking smart.
She was so on it. She was so on it. She was so
like, yeah, God told you. How convenient. And you know, Aisha learned from Muhammad, if the stories are true, because when Muhammad died, you know, every time Muhammad needed something, he was like, oh, there's a verse coming from God. And Aisha needed something when Muhammad died. She was always like, I'm remembering that Muhammad did something.
And then we have Abu Huraira, who was the biggest hadith distributor, even more than Aisha.
More than Aisha?
Aisha is 2,560 something. He's 2,500 and 600. And basically,
oh my God, it's so close.
It's really close. Abu Huraira was only with Muhammad for 4 years, and to the point where Umar was beating the shit out of him, going, "Why are you keeping making a hadith?" Because he was just like, "Yo," and you know the excuse that people give about Abu Huraira is like, "No, brother, sister, no, he had this amazing memory. It was like he would say it once and he would repeat it 10 years later. It was just like it's magical." And Umar was like, why are you just stop doing other things?
It's like, dude, why are you still here? It's like, go on Jeopardy. You know,
but you know, between Muhammad's death and the time that Osman actually canonized the Quran, there's a lot of shit that happened that we have. Yeah. Like a lot of people talk about how much of the hadith is true, but the Quran itself was not written down for a very long time. And Umar himself didn't canonize the Quran because he said that if we were supposed to turn it into a book, Muhammad would have turned it into a book. So that's why he didn't do it. And then Osman decided to fuck this shit with turning this into a book because people started forgetting shit, right? And people's accounts of the Quran kept on contradicting each other. And people were like, no, this is, and a whole bunch of surahs went missing. And parts of it got eaten by a goat. That was a good thing.
Like the stoning to adultery verse.
Yeah, I love that
Umar. It was Umar who was like, that definitely existed. And the people were like, no, we don't remember that.
Umar stoned people because they're like, I don't care if there's not a verse. I remember there was a verse about this. But it never, but so he stoned people, right? Because he remembered the verse. But anyways, but the fact is that we have no, a lot of people say, oh, Quran never changed. But between the time that Muhammad died and Osman turned into book, we have no idea what happened because Osman burned, after he decided to canonize the Quran, he burned everything else. I know, and there's a story even that Aisha came to Osman and told him specifically that this ayah is wrong and you have to change it. So Aisha herself changed the fucking verse in the Quran, right?
So, well, yeah, there was even during Abu Bakr's time, like when it comes to the hadith, right? There were so many. They actually said they themselves destroyed a whole bunch of hadith because they were being infiltrated. Hadiths were being infiltrated and put into their documents by the enemies that they were fighting at the time. And they were constantly at war. I mean, that's how Islam spread so fast.
Make a video about this. Can you make make a video about the hadith collection and the canonization?
More like a trilogy movie.
That's a very big thing. I mean, there's a lot of very interesting stuff. So, for example, I can't remember which Arif it was. Arif are like the different types of Quran. And there was one in, I want to say it was in Iraq, Kufa maybe. And basically Uthman was like, so there was one of the first Sahabas was promoting that in that location. And Uthman sent a delegation to him to go, look, dude, we're just making this one thing, just stop. And that guy literally sent the emissary back going, it was basically a fuck you because he was saying that I have been Muslim when Uthman was a hypocrite, when Uthman was a munafiq.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? He was saying basically this. So this Muslim guy was like, I was a Muslim when you were like, because Uthman turned Muslim basically a lot later.
His family was the last family.
Yeah, yeah. And it was his family that basically were the the Marwiyas kind of being kind of monarchical anyways. So Uthman's thing was very much like, yeah, I like being rich. I've got an empire. It's all cool.
So. This is they were the rich. They're kind of like the deep state because they were they were in power before. They were in power before Muhammad.
I was gonna say. What's that from Game of Thrones? You know the gold people.
Targaryens.
Lannisters. Because the Lannisters fall, the bank is still up. No, I think it's the bank because they stay always.
The money people.
I was saying, when you talk about the deep state.
Even though they were the main force against Muhammad, once Muhammad died, they still came back to power with Islam as the new ideology. Yeah. So that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, this is like for people who are kind of lost on this, I just want to repeat what I said before about the, you know, so if Trump was Muhammad and Jared Kushner is like Ali and Steve Bannon is like Abu Bakr, and then that's basically how it all started.
Osman is the deep state, people.
Osman is the deep state, of course. Yeah.
And Umar is like a psycho CIA.
The deep state is on Steve Bannon's side, right? So that's like on the caliphate side. So there's that's kind of how the Shia Sunni thing happened.
And then once Osman died, it was Osman's family that became the Umayyad Empire and took back control.
So but look at how well we're all getting now when we're ex-Shia and ex-Sunni, and you know.
I still have to be honest. I harbor a little bit of resentment for you guys because you're all so crazy. Shias are crazy.
It's good. A little bit of tension is good. I like it.
What are you guys doing? You guys killed all our people. You poisoned every single family. Muhammad himself specifically said, "My family, I leave two things to you, the Quran and my family." And
that's according to our hadith. That's according to our hadith. The biggest difference.
No. The difference is the interpretation. But he hold Ali's hand in the head. Sunni is to admit that. And then right after he died, Ali was burying Muhammad, and Abu Bakr and Omar were like going in a meeting and strategizing on who's getting the power.
Okay.
And this for years and years, every single descendant of Muhammad
poisoned. So one of the biggest. If anybody asks me, like, what's the difference between Shia and Sunni? The first thing I always tell them, I'm like, we've got different sources of hadith.
Yeah.
Okay, the Shia hadith come from the Ahlul Bayt, which is like the Muhammad's family and relatives. And the Sunni hadith come from, you know, the Bukhari and the Abu Huraira and all those other volumes. So that is the difference. So the stories that you're saying, everything we heard, I know what you're talking about.
I've read this, the part of the stories that everybody agrees on. It still looks like Hussein was fucked and cheated on. It seems like
everybody agrees on that.
I still take Ali and Hussein. So Hassan was a bit like a
liar.
But Hussein and Ali, they were Fatima, what the fuck? Like, they stole all her inheritance. They were like, no, this belongs to the Muslim community.
That's what the German academic was saying. That originally Muhammad had declared
this
her.
This is my dad's land. They're like, no, it's every Muslim's lands now. Like,
you know, I think that's quite democratic, mashallah. It's very, very
mashallah. And on that note, right. Very democratic, mashallah.
Anyway, tell people how they can find you.
Yeah. We're going to come to that. I'm going to have to sadly say that, you know, we're going to have to end this here because, you know, we're pretty much up to 2 hours. Imtiaz, we have to have you back on, man. I still have so many things to ask you and talk to you about. And I'm sure Armin feels
the very,
same
very
way.
Interesting. I love that, like, we have, like, we're ex-Muslims, but we're obviously so fascinated by Islam. You know, there's a political element, there's an academic. It's fun, isn't it? It's quite a fun.
Hey, listen, if you're treating cancer, you know, I mean, I'm a cancer pathologist, and I am very, very interested in cancer. That's
exactly.
Yeah.
Fun. So where do people find you? You're on Twitter, right? Twitter, Facebook, all that. Yeah, tell us.
Yeah, I've got all. Yeah, so my Twitter is at imtishams, imtishams. I've got a YouTube channel that does stuff for ex-Muslims, but it's very like niche. It's like helping ex-Muslims deal with their stuff.
It's a great channel.
Yeah, it's a good channel if you're an ex-Muslim, but like it is, you know, and Salsala is my channel for like academic stuff around Islamic history. The big thing though is my charity program, which is called Faith to Faithless. And that one, you know, it's part of the Humanist UK now. It's, you know, it's really something that I'm very proud of because it's run by apostates. So people who leave faith, you know, for apostates. It's not about ex-Muslims. It's about all of us, right? Because we all have different problems leaving Islam, religion, no matter what, you know, background we're from.
It's for non-Muslims, like people who left other religions as well.
So for example, Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses have it so hard when they leave. If they leave and their parents don't cut them off, their parents get cut off from the community, right?
Right.
So
we had Lloyd,
we had him
on the podcast previously, exactly. Which is a great episode. So you guys should check it out if you haven't heard it yet. We're going to put all those links in Imtiaz in the description. They're all going to be there. So all of the stuff, your charity, both of your YouTube channels, we do have a lot of listeners in Muslim majority countries. So even though, and that's what we're kind of working on right now, it's mainly in English, but we're working on transcripts.
Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia,
Bangladesh.
Yeah.
I don't know how many we get. Iran doesn't give any stats for some reason. We don't get Facebook stats from Iran or any Nipson stats for some reason. So I don't know how many people. But I know these countries that I mentioned, we have a lot of we have a lot of listeners in Saudi Arabia. Can you believe that? Awesome. By the way, shout out to the people in the live chat. If James, Sayed, Mike, Obey, thank you for your questions. And I just want to make sure, if you're a patron, please, we have a private Facebook group for patrons. If you don't have a link to it, please ask us for it. I'll send you a link to it. And it's for patrons only. And over there, we will have discussions. So please join that group if you're a patron. And also Sayed mentioned that he loved the Sunni Shia fight that we just had. We should have an episode dedicated to comparing Sony and Shia's love.
That'd be fun. Yeah. You should do that.
Why don't we do that? You should come back for something like that. But there's so much other stuff I wanted to talk to you about here that we didn't get to. And I really mean it. I'd love to have you back on so we can talk about it and really dig into it. Yeah. Right? So, awesome. And I know it's really late there. It's like, what time is it there?
Yeah, thank you so much.
2:40.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good thing is that we have daylight savings time. So we used to be 5 hours apart just last week, and now we're just 4 hours.
I sleep at this time anyways. I work a lot. So this is cool.
Okay. So that's great. So we're going to let you go, man. You can sleep.
I'm just going to the live chat, but just stay on for a little bit. Well, but anyways, thank you guys, everybody in the live chat.
See you next time. Yeah. Bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.